sermons on the family. I began with the marriage and the husband and the wife relationship and God's attitude toward that and what we should be building. And then I continued on with the end result of a marriage in the beginning of children. So last week I dealt with the children and the age group from a few months on up to 10, 11 years old. And so we're going to progress on. We're going to progress on to the next step. And that's the age group from 12 on up to the time that they marry and go out and establish their own homes. And in this time, if you'll notice in the past ones, past two sermons, it has been heavily oriented toward the parents. In fact, it was basically total preaching towards the parents. Because it's basically a parental responsibility in the marriage and then in the dealing with the children up to about 11 years old. It's basically a matter of teaching, instructing, setting example, dealing with the kids and the discipline and that sort of thing. But when you get up to age 12 and on, there comes a not too subtle a change. And so the sermon today is going to have somewhat of a change. It is going to be directed both toward the parents and toward the kids. And the reason for that is because things change. Circumstances change. Children change at that particular age. They change in their thought process and they change physically. And the parents' role change. And I'll talk a little more about that later on. One of the things that comes up at about this age, and one of the statements that you youngsters make to your parents is that you don't understand. I think that's one of the favorite statements that parents run into when kids reach about 12 on up through age. Well, you just don't understand. Well, in many ways, as a minister, Meryl and I have talked about it. We are partially responsible, along with your parents, in parenting you, in dealing with you and answering your questions and counseling and dealing with this subject of children and teenagers. And so it comes probably to your mind, you may not say it to me, well, Mr. Wilson, you don't understand. Well, kids, just let me get one thing straight for all of you. Parents do understand if they're really striving and working and growing the way they should in preparation for their kids being teenagers. Parents do understand, and as a minister, I do understand too. Because one of the things about being a minister is the fact that I don't run out of kids. Now, you maybe have a family of three or four, and maybe it took you a period of maybe 5 or 6 or 7 years to conceive those three or four kids. Well, in that same 5, 6, 7 year period of time, once the first one hits 16, well, it's just a matter of time, 6 or 7 years, and your grandparents, you're living alone. But as a minister, by the time they reach that particular period of time, somebody else in the congregation has conceived, you know, the same number of kids, and it goes on as an unending story. And so consequently, I counsel your parents about how to deal with you as teenagers, and if time goes on and I'm left in Portland, I'm going to be counseling with you on how to deal with your teenagers. Because as long as I'm pastoring a church, I never run out of kids. I never run out of them. They're always going to be 40. In the congregation that are teenagers. And after you deal with that for a good number of years, how can you come to me or come and say, you don't understand? Well, I'd have to be awfully stupid to not understand. How many kids does it take before you begin to catch on? Because, you know, Marilyn and I reared three of our own, and now then, you know, I've been pastoring the Portland South Church for 6 years, going on 7. And, you know, you do begin to catch on. It may take a long time, but you do begin to catch on.
For example, what about your attitudes toward the church? You know, what about your attitudes toward the church? You say, well, you don't know my attitude. Oh, well, I wouldn't say that. Your parents probably know the attitude. They try to improve it in some cases. But you know, you kids have varying attitudes toward the church. Some of you are sitting out here because you have to. Because you have to. Now, that's in the minority. Some of you are here because you want to be, because you enjoy the association with the rest of the kids in the church. That's where your friends are. Some of you are here because that's where your friends are. Some of you are here because you don't dislike the church, you don't disbelieve the church, you don't distrust the church, and you someday realize that you'll undoubtedly be a part of the church. And then some of you are here as I said before, because your parents make you be here, and some of you just don't believe the church at all because you have the world outside and you see what they say, and you frankly agree with them. And you don't think we understand, and you don't think we're up to date. You think we're back in the 1800s somewhere, when really we're back at 2000 instead of 1800, if you really get down to it, and back 4000. So there are varying attitudes about the church. And some of you listen to the sermons, some of you could care less. And some of you sit in church and don't listen to the sermons. Well, I honestly wish, that today you'd listen. Because I've, made remarks about the terrible teens, and I've made the remarks about chewing you out and giving you a hard time today, but I'm not going to. I'm really not going to at all. And I wish you would listen. I really do wish you would listen. Because I think there are going to be some very valid and valuable points for you, as well as for the parents. And so I really honestly wish that you get the girls out of your minds, get the basketballs and the volleyball games out of your mind, or whatever you have planned for this evening, or whatever you might have in your mind. I just wish you'd sit and listen for a change. All of you. Because what I'm going to say, I'm not going to harass you, I'm not going to make fun of you, because I like teenagers. But I wish you would listen. When you come up to about age 12, and you probably heard this before. You probably heard it before, you parents and you kids. There's a change comes upon you. We hadn't seen our grandson in about a year and a half. And he's 12 now. He's 12. When we went down to the feast, he was 12. And you can hardly believe, not necessarily in stature, he wishes he was 6 inches taller so he could do better at basketball, but not necessarily in stature, but in his thought process and what he was, the way he approached things, the way he thought about things, wow, what a difference. What a difference a year or a year and a half can make. It was an incredible change. And at about age 12, there is a tremendous change takes place in teenagers, they're not teenagers, but at about that age, there's a tremendous change takes place physically and mentally. Physically and mentally. Actually, you begin to reach a crossroads. Up to this particular time, in dealing with your parents said, do this or do that. And basically, in most homes in God's church, they did it within reason, up to about 11 years old, because they knew they had the Board of Education to face if they didn't do it. But you get up to that age, why, there's a change. There's a change comes. And transition, you actually are changing from a child to an adult. And it takes about 8 or 9 years before you make the change from a child to an adult. And in that change process, you run into an interesting situation. You run into a combination of things. The parents have to change their discipline practices, and you have to change your approach. And it's a combination of things.
It's a combination of things. Combination of two things. First of all, you still have to follow the instruction of your parents, and your parents have a lot to learn on this subject too, that they need to expect your children to follow your instructions. But then on the instructions, in the way you give the instructions, there's a change. Because within your instructions and your guidance and your directions, you have to leave room for decision making. In other words, the kids at that age begin to get to the point where they have to make decisions. That's why the constant hassle about wanting more freedom. They didn't think about that down here at these younger ages. But they get up at these other ages, they want more freedom. They want to be able to run their lives more. They want to be able to make their own decisions. Well, somewhere between just totally ignoring them and just allowing them to make all of their decisions, somewhere in between there, you as parents have to develop the ability, the knowledge, and the wisdom to give them instructions and guidelines and expect them to abide by those instructions and guidelines with penalties if they don't, and giving them freedom to make their own decisions. And it's not always easy. It's kind of a gray area. It's not easy as a parent to say, well, okay, you can take the car tonight, but you know, you have to be in at 12, or you have to be in at 10, or whenever you have to be, and you can only go such and such a place and such a place. In other words, you give them the freedom, but there are always strings attached. And those strings, of course, are sometimes what the youngsters resent. The parents have to gain that wisdom and the understanding on how to do that. And your kids have to understand that the parents are going to give you freedom, but there's always going to be strings attached. Because you're in that in-between period. You're in between the time when you have the experience and the knowledge and the ability to make all your own decisions, in between that time and the time when every decision was made for you. And so you're in a transitional period of growing up and becoming an adult. And it takes time. And you need to remember, kids, that you are not the first ones to be in that period of time. In Proverbs, the 4th chapter, Solomon put it this way. And you need to think about this. In Proverbs, the 4th chapter, Solomon put it this way. He says, listen or hear, you children, the instruction of your father, and attend to no understanding. In other words, you're going to gain understanding from your parents, whether you really like it or not. You know, when it comes to driving, I guess, when you're 16 and you're just beginning to drive, you think you are an expert driver. But not necessarily so. You find out that 5, 10, 15 years down the line, that you'll get fewer traffic tickets, you'll have fewer accidents, and it really, something that everybody already knew, you are a much better driver. But somehow it's awfully hard to tell you at that age that you really are a lousy driver. It's awfully hard to tell you because you know you just passed the test. That proves that you're a good driver, doesn't it? No, it doesn't prove that. That just proves that you're capable of getting the machine around without breaking the law. And I think sometimes it's difficult, and about the main thing it takes to convince youngsters sometimes is a good snowstorm. You know, they drive around on dry pavement all year, and it's fairly easy to maneuver a vehicle. But give them a snowstorm and maybe a little ice, and they find out they don't have the slightest clue on how to handle it. And after a few wrinkled fenders and a few dents, they begin to realize, well, I've never had any experience driving on snow and ice. I always drove on dry pavement. Well, it's an experience you didn't have. Your dad or your mom probably driven several years around on ice and snow. And they know what to do, and they know how to slow down, they know how to handle the brakes, and they just automatically do it. Well, how did they arrive at that knowledge? It was through experience. And it took years to come to that knowledge. Well, that's a little example of what I'm talking about. Listen to what your parents have to say. He says, "For I give you good doctrine, forsake you not my law. For I was my father's son." He said, "I was a youngster once. I had a father." Every youngster has a father, somewhere along the line, and a mother. "I was my father's son, tender and only beloved in the sight of my mother." Now, I had a father and a mother. I was a teenager once. "He taught me also and said unto me, let your heart retain my words. Keep my commandments and live." Now, if you'll listen, you'll get wisdom, you'll get understanding, and don't forget it. "Forget it not, neither decline to the words of my mouth. Forsake her not, and she shall preserve you. Love her, and she shall keep you." In other words, those words are going to help you through these periods of time. The wisdom, the knowledge, the understanding, the experience that your father and mother have gained is going to be passed along to you, and they're not out to destroy you. Most parents are not out to get rid of their kids or destroy them. Most parents are just like it says here. "He taught me, I was my father's son, tender and beloved in the sight of my mother." My mother. Most fathers and mothers feel that way about their kids. That's the way they should. Wisdom is a principal thing. You gain wisdom from teaching and from experience. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all you're getting, get understanding. Exalt it. And then down in verse 10, it says, "Hear, my son, and receive my saying, and the years of your life are going to be many." We're not trying to shorten your life. We're not trying to destroy your life. We're trying to help give you long life and a productive life, a happy life, an enjoyable life. And it is a parental responsibility to help the kids to enjoy life in a right way, to help them to have the good things. You know, we as parents should be wise. Over in the book of Job, the 32nd chapter, there was a young man by the name of Elihu that gave a biblical principle. And I think if you kids will think about this, you can understand it. If your parents have been teenagers at one time and had parents that instructed them, and they've gone through all the things that you've gone through and are now parents, shouldn't they have gained some knowledge during that period of time? Shouldn't they have something up here? Sure they should. Sure they should. Here in Job, the 32nd chapter, beginning in verse 5, when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of the three men, this is dealing with Job and his friends, then his wrath was kindled. Elihu, the son of Barachel and Buzite, answered and said, "I am young, and you are very old. Wherefore I was afraid and durst not show mine opinion. I said, days should speak, and multitude of years should teach wisdom." Just a simple biblical principle that the older you are, the more experience you have, and the more wisdom you should have. Sad to say. Sad to say, in our generation, you look at the world around you, and you can't honestly say that about the world around you. Just as Elihu could not say that about Job and his two friends. But under normal circumstances, days or years should speak, and a multitude of years should teach wisdom. It's a principle of the Bible, really, as God laid it down, and yet it's common, ordinary sense, that as you grow older, you should gain in knowledge and experience and wisdom, and you should know more, because you've had more years to know it. And in Leviticus 19 and verse 32, it tells you, very plainly, it says, "You shall rise up before the hoary head," or the gray hair, "and honor the face of the old man, and fear your God, I am your Lord.
Well, now, why is that? Just because older people, you just automatically are supposed to respect them? No, it's because older people should have more knowledge and more wisdom through studying, through experiences, and you young people need to learn to respect age and experience and knowledge. You can learn from it. It says the same thing over in Proverbs 16, verse 31. Proverbs 16, verse 31. He says, the hoary head or the gray head is a crown of glory if, Proverbs puts the practical sense to God's law in Leviticus 19. Puts the practical sense. It says, the gray head or age is a crown of glory if, a big word, an awfully big word, even though it only has two letters, if it be found in the way of righteousness. Now, many of you kids, or most of you, your parents are part of God's church. And they are striving to be righteous. They're not perfect, but they're striving to be righteous. They're striving to serve God. They're striving to do it God's way. And you need to recognize that. And respect that. And respect the experience and the years that they have. And the direction that they're going to give you is going to be good direction. It's not going to be bad direction. Over in Ephesians 6, it says, children, obey your parents. This is directed right toward the children. In the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and your mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you, and that you may live as long upon the earth. In other words, listen to your parents as they teach you the proper way to live. As our parents, as I've spent a lot of time in these first two sermons going through and explaining that parents are responsible for teaching their children by example and actually teaching them through discipline and so on, they're responsible for teaching God's way of life. And most of the parents are doing a relatively fine job in that area. Now, we all fall short, and none of us do it perfectly, but basically your parents are striving to do it the right way. And the advice that they're giving you is not to make you miserable, not to destroy you, but that you might have, that you may live long upon the earth, that you might have a good life and a proper life. Because just stop and think about it. Your parents are not out to get you. They're not out to destroy you. That isn't even logical. Sometimes you act as though that's the way it is. Now, I realize and understand that you're growing up, that you need make decisions, you need to learn how to make decisions and to live your life. And the further you go along as the years proceed, the more you should be able to do that. And I agree, and I know that the parents need to be careful that they're not treating you like a 6-year-old or a 5-year-old or a 4-year-old or a 2-year-old. Now, some of your actions may border on that. But the parents do need to be careful to make sure they're kept up with the time, to make sure that they're aware of what's going on in society around them and any changes that are necessary, that are proper in what decisions they may or directions they may give. And it's a very fine line. It's a very difficult line for parents. It's a very difficult line for parents to let out that leash and to let you make those decisions. That's why most of them recoil and react the way they do when you violate the instructions, and when you go out and you do what you should not do, the parental reaction is, if you're going to act like a 10-year-old, treat them like a 10-year-old. And usually when you violate something that the parents have given you liberty in, the parental automatic reaction is to take away the liberty
until you learn how to handle it. And so you've got a responsibility here, too, as well as the parents. And it's not an easy decision. It's a tough decision. And the society in this day and age, they just don't make it any easier. They don't make it any easier because we have temptations and trials that are thrown in front of you continually. You know, it's like in one church area, a 15-year-old announced to her parents and to her minister that she was going to go out and get pregnant. Not a question. It was not a discussion. It was a statement of fact. And she defied her parents to do anything about it. She said, I'll run away from home if you don't. Well, that's a pretty tough drawing of line. And it gets to be a situation where parental guidance in that case is just thrown to the wind. And it's too bad. It really is too bad. Because it creates all sorts of problems. It makes it an impossible position for the parents. And it also is going to lead to disaster in the individual's life. And it is a dumb decision. The tendency on the parents' part, if it were possible, would be to lock them in a closet with bars on it until they learn to straighten up their ass and get their mouth where it belongs and get their head where it belongs and make a decision that's half respectable of anyone who has any intention of ever growing up to any age or for any happiness. It's incredible. I tell you, it takes the wisdom of Solomon to deal with some of those problems and issues that come up. And we as parents don't always have the wisdom that Solomon has. And so it takes cooperation on the part of you kids. But your parents, you as parents, need to have this particular attitude about it. But bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of God. In other words, we have God's word and way of doing things. And we need to stick to it as parents. And always use that as our yardstick and our guidance and direction. Over in Proverbs 1, verse 8, again a restatement. Proverbs 1, verse 8. It says, my son, hear the instructions of your father. Listen to the instructions of your father and forsake not the law of your mother. Those are simple words, simple terms, but yet they're all so true. And that's the point I want to get across to you kids today, as well as getting across to you parents, to realize and understand that you have a lot of studying to do, you have a lot of praying to do, you have a lot of communicating between a husband and a wife, and you have a lot of discussion and teaching to do with your kids, even in the teenage. Because they're going to learn things faster, and they're going to apply them, they're going to deal with them in a different way than they did in younger years. And it's going to take a lot of wisdom on your part. And we're to pray for wisdom. But you know, you get down on your knees and you pray for wisdom. I think there's some people assume, well, now I've done that takes care of wisdom, I'll go on to the next thing. You need to pray for wisdom, but not just pray for wisdom. Because wisdom comes from knowledge. And understanding comes from experience. And when you explain and when you have the knowledge and the experience, you have the wisdom. You don't get wisdom just by praying. But through praying, God will open your mind to see and understand His scriptures and how to apply them in an individual situation, and then you've got wisdom. And we need to pray about it, we need to study about it, and we need to ask God to give us that wisdom that comes from this book. And then you kids need to make sure that you listen to the instructions of your father and your mother, because they're doing it for your good. They're trying to help you through an interesting period of life, a very interesting period of life, a period of life when you're changing from a child to an adult. And the end result's going to be an adult. Well, sad to say, in some circumstances, in this day and age, the kids don't make it through those 8 or 9 or 10 years. They don't. don't make it through to become an adult. It's really sad. It's really sad because it's an exciting time of years. It's, you know, the little kids, they present their fun and their challenges. But the teenage years are the most fun, really, for parents, except for the odd occasion. They're the most fun because you see the result of your teaching. You see the result of them. You see it beginning to expand. You see their minds expand. You see their bodies expand. And you see it all going on, and you're seeing an adult in the making. And it is. It's a lot of fun. They're enjoyable. They're exciting. They have all sorts of energy. They want to do a million things. And, you know, it really is an exciting time for parents, if you let it be. But again, it does present its problems, and it's not easy. And it takes cooperation and working with, as far as the children are concerned, as far as the adults are concerned. Over in the Luke, the second chapter, we have the example of Jesus Christ. Now, he does serve as one of the better examples in the Bible. The best. But we have an example of Jesus Christ at 12 years old. At 12 years old. Going through the same things you kids go through. He was 12 years old. And it's kind of interesting, the things we can learn about how he acted and reacted at 12 to situations and then circumstances. So we pick it up in verse 40. Pick it up in verse 40. You must notice how Jesus Christ handled situations at age 12. The age we're talking about, from 12 on up and today. And the child grew, waxed strong in spirit, filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. Now his parents went up to Jerusalem every year at the Feast of the Passover. So we're going to have the Passover and then going up to the Passover. Of course, the whole family went. And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. So at 12 years old, something special happened. Something different happened in Jesus Christ's life. And when they had fulfilled the days, as they returned, the child of Jesus tarried behind in Jerusalem. Now, he'd gone up there 12 years in a row. But he did something out of character. For the first time, even after his parents left, he stayed in Jerusalem. I'm not saying he was wrong, because Jesus Christ never committed a sin. But he did something that, frankly, probably his parents disagreed with. Probably his parents disagreed with it. Because here he'd come along to 11 years old, he'd gone up with the same group to Jerusalem every Passover, and he'd gone back with them. But all of a sudden, at 12 years old, he made a decision. Jesus Christ made a decision regarding his parents. And this is the first time you'll find in Scripture that he made an individual decision regarding his parents. And he decided on his own to stay behind. Stay behind in Jerusalem and let them leave. Well, you can imagine the parental reaction. What if you were in that circumstance? You've been going up to Jerusalem, or you've been going to Eugene to the feast every single solitary year. In your family situation, maybe 30, 40, or 50 of you in the family. Every year, kids come back. All of a sudden, one year, a 12-year-old decided he had more important business than Eugene. What would be your reaction? You know, or you can just imagine what his parents thought about that. But at any rate, at 12 years old, Jesus Christ made that decision. And so, and when they were filled with days, he returned. The child Jesus tarried in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother didn't know it. He didn't ask his parents. He didn't ask his parents. He just did it. Well, but they supposing him to have been in the company, went a day's journey. And they saw him among the kinfolk and the acquaintances. So there were quite a few in the crowd. And they just didn't miss him. They didn't miss him for a whole day. Interesting, isn't it, when you read the story. And when they found him not, they turned back again to Jerusalem, seeking him. So they went back to find him, which is a natural parental response. It came to pass that after 3 days, it took him 3 days to find him. Can you imagine the frenzy that his mother was in at this particular juncture? It came to pass that after 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions. So at the end of the 3 days, they found him in the temple. They found him in the temple. When they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said unto him, "Why have you thus dealt with us?" It showed your attitude. It showed her attitude about the whole situation. She said, "Why? Why did you do to this to us, son? We were scared silly, wondering where you were. We looked for you and looked for you and looked for you, and here we've been looking for you for 3 days." And can you imagine the reaction of the parents? You can just put yourself in the picture. "Behold, your father and I have sought you sorrowing." I mean, they loved him. They loved him, and they were really concerned about him, and they were worried that he'd gotten into some trouble. Then Jesus Christ made a statement. Because Jesus Christ at age 12 was changing from a child and maturing toward an adult. And he had come to realize that he had another father. He had come to realize that he had another father. That was God the Father. And he had come to begin to realize that he had a responsibility toward God the Father. And so he automatically gave this response. And he said unto them, "How is it that you sought me? Would you not that I must be about my Father's business?" In other words, he had come to the conclusion it was time for him to be about God the Father's business, to react to God the Father. But was it time? He was right. He was absolutely right, because he had come to the knowledge that he was the Son of God. He had come to the knowledge through the teaching of his parents that he had another father that he had an obligation to. He'd come to that knowledge, he'd come to that understanding at age 12. And so when this circumstance came up, he didn't want to leave Jerusalem. His obligation was toward God the Father, he thought. But was his obligation to stay in Jerusalem and to take up his ministry and to serve God the Father in that capacity? Was that what he was responsible for doing? No, it wasn't what he was responsible for doing. And he explains it. It's explained here in the next three verses. Because look what Jesus Christ did. "And they understood not the saying which he spoke to them. And he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject unto them. But his mother kept all these things in her heart." When he heard this, when his parents made the statement they said, and after he'd made the statement he made, he realized he had an obligation to his physical parents. And Jesus Christ then, realizing that and understanding that he had an obligation to God the Father, yes, and true enough he did. But also he realized he had an obligation to his physical parents. And so what did he do when he realized and came to the understanding that he had two obligations, to God the Father and to his parents? Well, he responded to both of them, really. But he went ahead and responded to his parents. And he went down and was subject unto them. But his mother kept the sayings in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. He learned a very valid point and gained in wisdom. He learned that at 12 years old, you are subject to your parents, and you don't run away from home. And you don't stay away from home, and you're not without obligation to your parents at 12 years old. And he also had the wisdom to see that he was to be subject to his parents at 12 years old. He remained subject to his mother and his father because he realized that was part of his obligation. Even though he knew that somewhere down the line, he was no longer going to be subject to his mother and father, but he was going to be subject to God the Father, and that he had a special calling.
But through this process, you can see his learning and teaching. He learned from this incident. Because you're not going to find this repeated. I'll guarantee you, in his 13th year, he didn't stay behind in Jerusalem, even though they went up to the Passover. He didn't stay behind in the 14th year, or the 15th year, or the 16th year, and probably not in the 20th year did he stay behind. Because Jesus Christ was in a learning mode, too. He learned. He didn't know everything to start with. And Jesus Christ learned. And he was subject to his parents. And we need to take his example, and we need to live by it. And you kids need to realize, just as Jesus Christ realized, that at age 12, you're still subject to your parents. Even though you may understand, even though you may have the knowledge and realize that you have a higher obligation. Well, he went on through the years realizing he had a higher obligation, but also realizing that he had an obligation toward his mother and his father. And it's a valuable lesson, as far as I'm concerned, for you kids to realize. Okay, let's go to Proverbs 3. Proverbs 3. If I can find it here. I got too many things in my Bible. Proverbs 3, beginning of verse 21. He says again, "My son, let not them depart from your eyes. Keep sound wisdom and discretion. Learn these lessons." Listen to what I'm telling you today and what Jesus Christ did, and learn. Learn from these experiences and gain in wisdom. Let them not depart from your eyes. So shall your life be unto all to your soul and grace to your neck. Then shall you walk in your way safely, and your foot shall not stumble. Your parents are going to give you advice and guidance and direction that's going to keep you in safety and keep you from stumbling. Don't forget, they have been there. They have been there. And we have a multitude of examples in the Bible of it. And remember, take the advice of your mother and your father. Listen to them. Obey what they tell you to do. Be subject unto them, as Christ was subject unto his parents. Christ was subject unto his parents. And you will walk safely, and your foot's not going to stumble. All of these things that you want to do, maybe that are adult things, you'll have the opportunity to do them when you've gained the knowledge, the wisdom, the understanding, and have the ability and the talent and the, all that goes into it to handle it. You don't automatically, at 12 years old, know how to do all these things. And you don't all of a sudden, at 17 years, know how to handle and do all these things. It takes experience, it takes teaching, it takes guidance, it takes direction, and eventually, those things will come and you'll have that knowledge and that wisdom and that understanding. When you lie down, you're not going to be afraid. There is security at home, and there should be security at home. Sometimes they accuse God's church of teaching scare religion. We don't teach scare religion. Now, we don't mince words if the Bible says what it says. It does say that. But I don't see you kids just absolutely petrified and scared. You shouldn't be. You shouldn't be afraid of your parents. Your home should be a place where you enjoy going and where you feel secure. And in a time of counsel or in need of counsel, in the time of when you're faced with something you don't know how to handle, you should be able to go home and talk to your mom and dad about it. And mom and dad should be able to understand and help you with it. You should have peace and safety and not be afraid in your home. It's a place to always retreat to. Yes, you shall lie down and you shall sleep sweet. Be not afraid of sudden fear, neither of the desolation of the wicked when it comes. Now, you don't have to worry about the great tribulation. You don't have to worry about the beast power. You don't have to worry about the false prophet. You don't have to worry about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. If your parents are teaching you and guiding you and direct you, you kids don't have time to worry about that. I hope you're not worrying that there's going to be an atomic bomb explode tomorrow over Portland, and you're not going to live 3 weeks more, and you've got to get it all in 3 weeks. If you listen to your parents and do what your parents tell you, they'll guide and direct you and help you, you're not going to have those problems. You've got as secure a future as anyone in the entirety of the universe, even more secure than the rest of the world. Be not afraid of sudden fear, neither of desolation or the wicked when it comes, for the Lord shall be your confidence and shall keep your feet from being taken. You've got projection. You've got a way of life that, quite frankly, the kids in this world are, in many cases, would be very envious of. Sometimes you envy the kids who are not in the church, but I'll tell you this. The kids who are not in the church should be envying you. Because I look at what you do as a congregation just in your basic life. You know how many parents in Oregon allowed their kids to go to Acapulco for the feast? Or to St. Petersburg, Florida, or to Pensacola, or Corpus Christi? How many kids have their families planning a trip to England next year? Or have taken their children to Czechoslovakia for a feast? Or gone to Australia or Tahiti or wherever else they might go for a feast? And to do the things that you have done. You kids have traveled more and seen more and experienced more than 99% of the kids in this world. I grew up out here in Clackamas County, a little place called Hillsview. Remember a young man that was a little older than his name, and his name was Wilbur Olson. He lives out there, and he still lives out there. And the last I had known, and this would have been after I was in the Air Force and had been quite around in quite a few places, he hadn't been out of the state of Oregon. And you'd be surprised at how many kids in your class have not been out of the state. Or maybe over into Washington, made a real venture of it and gone over to Washington. You know, Washington, well, that's no adventure. You know, your parents probably take you, you know, to a place like that almost every week. You kids have opportunities to do and to be and have things that just aren't made available through. Then they come through God's church and through God's way of life. Your parents judiciously save their second tithe and plan for it. And, you know, I grew up, as they say, and I guess I'm not necessarily typical, but I had never ordered a meal in a restaurant, as I explained to you, until I must have been, I would have had to have been, 26 or 27 years old before I'd ever ordered a meal in a restaurant. You think that's silly. You think, well, that's ridiculous. You mean you had never ordered a meal in a restaurant until you were 26 or 27 years old? Well, how many kids have gone into a restaurant like Maxie's here in Portland and ordered a steak and had the salad and the soup and all of the courses that go along with it and would know how to do it? How many kids would know when you order red or white wine? With red meat or with whatever. How many kids have ever even been to a meal like that? Would have the slightest clue on how to act in a situation like that? The majority of kids don't go through those things. The majority of kids never have those experiences. They don't have the opportunity. They really don't. Your kids have given anything and everything, and I hope you learn to appreciate it. And you parents, as it says in Proverbs 22, verse 6, clean up your children. Including the teenagers. Train them up in the way that they should go. And if you work together, when you're old, your kids are not going to depart from it. Because eventually, you outgrow the teenage, and you fall into the category found in Genesis 2. Genesis 2 and 24. Genesis 2 and verse 24. Therefore, shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. So eventually we go through the whole circle of the thing, finishing the cycle, starting with a man and a wife who get married, they have little kids, they go to teens, the teens grow up, and they then leave their mother and father, and they cleave to their husband and wife as one flesh, and they start the whole thing all over again.
They start the whole thing all over again, and you could just repeat the sermons, you know. I can save these for further down the line and just repeat them all over again. Because the new generation comes on, starts it all over again. There's a statement over in the 127th Psalm that seems like it might be a little far-reaching. Psalm 127, verse 1. And I've often thought about this. It says, Except the Lord build the house. Build the house. They labor in vain that build it. Unless the Lord keep the city, the watchman wakes, but in vain. And of course, the first part of this is talking about marriage, because it goes on and talks about children. And I used this in the beginning. And it seems like that's a little far-reaching, doesn't it? It says, except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain that build it. In other words, it's not going to last. There's no real purpose in it. But wait a minute. There are homes, and that's what this is talking about. It's not talking about a physical building. It's talking about a family and a home. There are homes and families where the parents have done really fine jobs. I'm prejudiced, but I feel my parents did a fine job in teaching us kids. But they didn't lay the foundation, they didn't build the foundation on the Bible. It was on what my parents thought and taught, and many of the principles were in the Bible. And us kids grew up with that teaching, with that instruction. And it went fine insofar as their children were concerned. But when it got down to grandchildren, that same teaching that my parents gave was not passed on to the children. Why wasn't the parents' teaching of my parents passed on by my brothers and sisters onto their children? Why wasn't it passed on? Because it didn't have the right foundation. It was mom and dad's ideas, and they were good ideas. But mom and dad died. And the ideas, in many cases, went into the grave with them. But the ideas that you as parents are supposed to be teaching are eternal ideas recorded in this book. And what you do is you teach your children where your ideas came from, and your children will have the same source to teach their children. And consequently, what has happened to the family? In the second, third, and fourth generation, when the principles are taught on the ideals and the concepts of the parents, good as they may be, in the second and third and fourth generation, it falls apart. It falls apart because it has the wrong foundation. It doesn't have something that endures for years. And these words have been here 6,000 years. The foundation is there all the time. And you teach your children that they build on that foundation, and the family will be preserved to the third and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth generation. That's where the problem comes with the world, and the world does have some very, very fine families. But they are not going to last and endure to many generations because the foundation is not this book. And you have the advantage, brethren, of having this foundation that doesn't change from generation to generation. These words are exactly the same as they were 30 years ago and 40 years ago and 2,000 years ago. It's a foundation that does not change. So therefore, your children have something to teach their children that is not going to change, that their children can then teach the other children, and if you build it on that foundation, it will last on into time. And it goes on to say the same about a city or a nation. You take the history of human nations. There's never been a nation built on this book. Not really. There have been nations that have started out. There have been nations that have had excellent ideas. tremendous foundations from man's point of view that had some of the concepts of this book. But there has never been a nation that built their nation specifically and totally and entirely on this book. If they had and had taught that to their children, that nation would have lasted through the entire 6,000-year history of man. Because anything built on anything less than this book is not going to stand, whether it be a nation or whether it be a family. And that's the value, brethren, of what we are teaching and of what you are being given. Open the book of James. The book of James, in talking about Abraham. Abraham is undoubtedly, outside of Jesus Christ, in God's mind, the greatest character and individual of the Bible. I don't think there's any question about it. Outside of Christ, that Abraham was the most outstanding individual in the entirety of the Bible. That's why in Galatians 3, God says that Abraham is the father of the faithful. That everyone who comes to God is going to have the faith that Abraham had. But here in James 2, it says an interesting thing about Abraham. James 2, verses 22 and 23. See you how faith wrought with his works, and by works was faith made perfect. And the scripture was fulfilled which said, Abraham believed God. Brethren, we need to believe God. You teenagers need to believe God. You parents need to believe God. And you need to act on it. And it was imputed to him for righteousness, and he was called. Abraham was called the friend of God. Now, over in John 15, Jesus Christ said that we could be his friends, too. John 15, and this is talking about a personal relationship. Abraham was called a friend of God. And John 15, verses 14 and 15. Jesus Christ, speaking to his disciples, says, you are my friends. Very interesting, very familiar statement. We know what a friend is. If you do whatsoever I command you. There was a big if in there. You're my friend if you do whatsoever I command you. Henceforth I call you not servants, for the servant knows not what his Lord does, but I have called you friends, for all things I have heard of my Father I have made known unto you. And so Jesus Christ called us, or said, that we could be his friends. Okay? Why was Abraham considered a friend of God, and how can we be friends of God and friends of Christ? Very simply explained in the book of Genesis. Genesis, the 18th chapter. And frankly, brethren, the lesson we need to learn from the series of sermons that we just finished. Genesis, the 18th chapter. It's the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. We'll pick it up in verse 16. And the men rose up from thence, and they looked toward Sodom. And Abraham went with them to bring them on the way. So we know the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and what that was all about. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham the thing which I do? In other words, his plans, in other words, what was going to happen to Sodom and Gomorrah, he said, shall I keep that from Abraham? Shall I keep it back and just not tell him about it? Well, he decided that he would tell Abraham about what he was going to do to Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember when Jesus Christ said we could be his friends because he told us everything, he didn't hold back anything? Well, God looked at Abraham in a circumstance where he hadn't told Abraham what he was going to do. He'd already made up his mind what he was going to do with Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham didn't hate Sodom and Gomorrah. He had a nephew that lived there. Lot was there. He had family and relatives in Sodom and Gomorrah. And God just questioned his mind, well, shall I tell him or shall I not tell him what I'm going to do to Sodom and Gomorrah? Well, he says, I'm going to tell him. He decided, we'll find out. He says, I'm going to go ahead and tell him. Just as Jesus Christ said we could be his friends because he told us everything. He didn't hold anything back. And so God said, if he's my friend, I can just tell him straight up. And so we find here, verse 18, seeing that Abraham, he says, seeing that Abraham shall become a great and a mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. He says, I can tell it. Because Abraham is going to be a great person. He's going to be a great person in my eyes. And as a result of Abraham's actions and the way he is, he's going to become a mighty nation. Is going to spring from him. And all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed because of Abraham. And then in verse 19, he gives you the key, brother. The key to become great in God's eyes. The key to preserving a family, a house, or a nation. The thing that God respects and the thing that God needs to know about you and about me. He says, for I know him. Does God know you? Yes, he knows you. He says, I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him. In other words, he will be the head of the house, and he will guide and direct and teach and instruct his family. He says, I know that Abraham will do that, and they, his children, shall keep the way of the Lord, or God's way. And Isaac and Jacob did keep God's way. Now, after Jacob, it kind of fell apart. But for three generations, as a result of Abraham and the way he handled the situation, his family followed God's way of life. Incredible man Abraham was. And if we want the same result, if we want to be great with God, and we want to ensure the security of our family on into future generations, we're going to have to follow the faith of Abraham. And if we're going to be a friend of God's and a friend of Jesus Christ, we're going to have to command and teach our children and our household. And we're going to have to make that teaching strong enough and clear enough and desirable enough that it'll carry on for three or four generations. Then we have built a home that's going to stand. It's going to be firm. And they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken. There's how you're to build a home, brethren. That's the way it's supposed to be structured. You as a parent carry the big bulk of responsibility in ensuring that you establish that home on the principles of God and make sure that those principles are passed on and taught to strongly to your little children and also to your teenagers. And then expect your teenagers to grow up and expect them to go out and establish their homes on exactly the same principle. And if they do that, then they'll have a family, they'll have children, they'll go through all of the agonies and the ecstasies of parenthood, and then their children will go out using the same book, using the same scriptures, using the same principles, using the same foundations. They'll go out and get married, they'll have children, and it'll go on and on and on until the end of time. And brethren, really, when you really get it down to it, that is a way that a home should be built, and that's what a family structure should be all about.